And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. It is the podcast that is bringing to you some of the most interesting, informative, and I would say inspirational people on the planet. Before we get started with this particular edition of Hank Unplugged, some housekeeping. You can go to iTunes and give this podcast a 5-star rating, if indeed you believe it deserves a 5-star rating. Of course, share, rate, review. All of this happens so that this podcast might get to, well, eventually number one in the religion space. You can have a lot to say about that. So again, the call to action for you is to give this podcast a 5-star rating at iTunes and then let people know that they can consume this podcast wherever they consume their favorite podcasts. Today, I want to bring to you a conversation with Dr. Benjamin Weicker, who received his PhD from Vanderbilt University. He's also a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute. He's written some of my favorite books, including A Meaningful World, How the Arts and Sciences Reveal the Genius of Nature, and the book that we have been really excited about putting in the hands of people, 10 Books That Screwed Up the World and 5 Others That Didn't Help. This book, available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can check it out on the web at equip.org. Dr. Benjamin Weicker joins me for the second time on the Hank Unplugged podcast. Great to have you with us again, Benjamin.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back, very glad.
We are having so much fun with your book, 10 Books That Screwed Up the World and 5 Others That Didn't Help. This is incredibly important in that many people do not understand how today we are living in the midst of, well, maybe 500 years of a buildup to the post-truth culture that we're experiencing right now.
Exactly. And, you know, it's the old saying, that ideas have consequences, but that means that bad ideas have consequences, and they're bad consequences, and that's especially unpleasant when people don't realize the nature and the caliber of the ideas that they've inherited. They just accept them as if it were the air, you know, that they're breathing, or like a fish in water. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to wake people up and say, you know, you don't have to think this way. Here are the people that defined this wrong way to go. And the more you understand it, the more free you're going to become of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of these books are so draconian that you can hardly imagine that they would have been written, but they have been written by intellectuals. And you think perhaps the most malicious book ever written was the Manifesto of the Communist Party. I think you said something to the effect that seldom has a book so screwed up the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, just if you go just on body count alone, you know, you're talking well over 100 million people who were inspired who were the result of the Marxist inspiration about bringing in this communist utopia, which happened to a need to, you know, really consume more people. More people died from Marxism than any other cause by far, way, way, way more than has ever been caused by Christianity. Yet, it still has a hold on at least some of the intellectual elite in the universities, and it comes in new forms. It just keeps coming back. It's like the Hydra you can't kill.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the consequences for our society are pretty significant when you start to look at books like The Prince by Machiavelli, who you say was the original ends justify the means philosopher. He had this famous dictum that said, we cannot guide our lives by what is good. Instead, we have to guide our lives by what is effective.
Yes. And once you make that change, then there's nothing limiting what you do, because whatever is effective is effective. It might be effective to kill, you know, 10 million people. It might be effective to pretend you're religious and take over the church. You know, there's all kinds of things that could be effective, you know, kill babies. There's no end or limit to what means you can use to get what you want. And the thing about Machiavelli is, in order to set forth that doctrine, he had to reject Christianity, because no one could put forth that doctrine and care about his immortal soul. He must believe that he doesn't have one, and Machiavelli really is our first great modern atheist, and atheism undergirds then all the later the ends justify the means kinds of arguments in politics and ethics.
What do you make of where we are in human history at this point? We're sitting in the wake of a mass murder that took place in Las Vegas, another mass murder that took place in a small church in Texas. We have these waves of terrorism that come in like the ocean brings in its waves. We have the undertow of migration without assimilation, I've often likened to a python swallowing its prey with a long and slow digestion. You look at all of these kinds of things in toto, and they paint a pretty scary picture, but a picture that in some ways is predictable.
It is, yes. One thing that you find out with all the people, the books that I treat on the list, and actually, you know, it's not only 10, but I give you an extra 5, all of those are in some way, you know, have given over to the atheist side. So atheism undergirds the transformation and modernity from a Christian culture to a secular culture. And it's not just a secular culture, it's a reductionist, materialist culture where there really isn't anything to live for but this world. And so, you know, you find with this person in Texas that, you know, he's got his diatribe against Christians and thinks that religion is, you know, the most awful thing, and he's going to show how awful it is by a mass murder. And here you have what? You know, here's the convoluted reason that you found in Marxism. You know, God is the cause of all our horrors. If we just get rid of religion, everything would be wonderful, and we're going to kill all these people just to show you how wonderful, you know, Marxism is. You find this again and again, this pattern of a twisted understanding that results from the rejection of God and from a, you know, release from any kind of a moral compass in order to make this world into some kind of a utopia.
Yeah, and there is no such thing in the materialist perspective as right or wrong, good or bad. And so ultimately, if you are sitting in classrooms and you are hearing lectures on just rank materialism, you ultimately come to the conclusion that you might as well bite the bullet. This is something that many of the modern day philosophers and professors are doing. They're actually biting the bullet and saying, there is no good, there is no evil. History amounts to nothing. It's just a function of molecules in motion, and therefore do as ye will, sort of the Wiccan code.
Yeah, exactly. And these professors, these tenured radicals, so to speak, believe that they're on the cutting edge. You know, they've just discovered this, and, you know, they're in the vanguard of the intelligentsia. And as I make clear in the book, you know, well, that thinking has been going on quite some time. All you need to do is go back to Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, published in 1651, and he says that very bluntly, hey, you know, the world is just atoms in motion. There is no good or evil. There's just getting what you want, and you have the absolute right to get whatever you want in whatever way you can get it. And the thing about that universe, as he makes clear, is it's purposeless. That is, there's not really any goal to what you're doing except trying to, you know, get whatever pleasure you can while your, you know, molecules are still intact, and avoid whatever pain you can while your molecules are still intact. But it's a meaningless, purposeless universe. And so, you know, all of the so-called cutting-edge intelligentsia declaring nihilism in the 20th and the 21st century, they're really just great-great-grandsons of Thomas Hobbes. Now, that should make us want to study Thomas Hobbes and say, well, why did he say these things? What reason did he have? Because maybe he's just wrong, but these people have been influenced by his teaching. So if we can study the great founders of the evil frameworks like that, then again, we can become free of them and question them and say, why do I have to think that way? Maybe it's not true.
So a lot of people would say the ultimate good we could do for civilization in that ideas have consequences is we can have a massive book burning, start burning all of these books that have had these negative impacts on postmodern civilization. But you say, no, book burning is not the solution. The actual solution would be to read these books cover to cover and yes. understand what they have to say and why what they have to say is dangerous. And in essence, that's why you wrote 10 books that screwed up the world. I mean, you're giving people sort of a thumbnail sketch of why these books have the impact that they've had.
Yeah, and a lot of people's confusion is that they don't have the kind of clarity that the great founders of modern bad thought had. The reason you want to study these people, and this is everyone, you know, Machiavelli, The Prince, Rene Descartes' Discourse and Method, Hobbes, Leviathan, we got Rousseau, Marx, all these other ones. You want to read them because they had a clarity of mind. And so there, many of them are profoundly evil, that is, if you want to see what the real position is, if you want to see what it entails, if you want to, you know, remove the fuzziness and get to the people who really understood what they were saying, you want to read these books. So, you know, they actually, oddly enough, aren't read cover to cover by the very people who are touting the ideas that come from them, and it's very unlikely that many of them have even read them. They're just, you know, like third or fourth generation, you know, secondary and tertiary thinkers themselves. They think they're original, but they're not. So if you can go back to those original thinkers, and that's what I argue in the book you should do, then you can learn, oh, that's why they think that. Those are the ramifications ramifications of it. This is what it really means to live in a world without good and evil. That's why one of the people that we work with is Friedrich Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil. He understood that very clearly. And you know, so I'm trying to say this is what Nietzsche really thought, because a lot of people don't understand how radical he really was. They want to just kind of have a puppy dog version of some of these philosophers like Nietzsche, and they need to understand, you know, this is what it really means to say that there is no God. You're going beyond good and evil. There is no good and evil. It's simply made by the most powerful person.
Yeah, Thomas Carlyle, and you write about this in the introduction to your book. He was an eminent Scottish essayist and a longtime philosopher. And he was once scolded at a dinner party, as you lay this out, for chattering about books. And the scolding was something to the effect of ideas. Mr. Carlyle, ideas, nothing but ideas. And then he replied, yeah, there was once a man who was named Rousseau who wrote a book containing nothing but ideas, but the second edition of that book was bound in the skins of those who laughed at the first. And of course, Carlyle was right. And the ultimate or the quintessential example of his rightness is in Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote a book that inspired the ruthlessness of the French Revolution and even more destructive things after that. Now, a couple of things I want to bring out from what you've written there. One is when you think about the French Revolution and you know nothing about it whatsoever except seeing it idealized in Les Mis, you might think, well, French Revolution was good. You have to have some sense of history if you're not going to repeat it.
Exactly. And you know what you have in the French Revolution, it's really the first modern totalitarian regime which tried to eliminate Christianity. In other words, before that you had all kinds of people attacking Christianity, but you didn't have a political regime simply dedicated to its elimination. And so it wasn't just a poor against the rich thing. That was part of it, and you find that in Rousseau's Second Discourse. But it's also a Christianity is bad. It's so bad it has to be removed, and it has to be done by force, and then it has to be replaced by a civil religion that is one that is entirely aimed at the secular state. And so what happened in the French Revolution was you had a totalitarian regime come into being that literally was trying to exterminate Christianity and provide a really weird natural religion. And by that, it was rather an unnatural religion, but, you know, you're trying to replace saint days with, with days having to do with, you know, carpentry and, you know, certain kinds of flowers and trees, and starting over from, you know, year one and rejecting Christianity. So you're wiping Christianity out of history, but you're also murdering tens of thousands of priests and nuns and Catholics, anyone in your way that still holds to anything but the truths of the new secular regime. So that's the predecessor of the Marxist regimes that came in and tried to do the same thing. And this time, instead of murdering tens of thousands, they murdered tens of millions.
That's incredible when you think of those statistics. Sometimes they just sort of go by very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, you can relate yourself to a few things, maybe one or two murders, but when you think about 100 million or more, it's very, very difficult. I was in Cambodia last year.
Oh.
And I was at the killing fields themselves, and they have these great memorials. And when you look at these memorials, within the memorials themselves, they have literally tens of thousands of skulls of people who were murdered as a result of an idea.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's Marxism. That idea was Marxism, and that's small in comparison to what was not really next door, but it's close to there in China. Oh my gosh, I mean, I don't think we'll ever know. 50, 60 million? You know, how can we even count them up? The numbers just dwarf. You know, if you add together those numbers killed by communism, it's more than all the other wars in all the previous centuries combined. And yet, you still have atheists saying that religion is the cause of all our misery. That's amazing. How can you say that? You know, how can you think that the, you know, there's nothing ever been approaching this horrific destruction of human life? And if you add on top of that abortion and now euthanasia, it's you can't even fathom it. With this kind of destruction, yet the secular left still wants to maintain that that taking God out of the public realm will have no ill effects. In fact, it'll make things much more peaceful and better for everyone.
Yeah, it's interesting that you have a liberals actually siding with Islam, saying Islam is a religion of peace because the real danger to Western civilizations, in their view, is Christianity.
Exactly. And that's been a kind of a trope that they've been repeating. You can actually bring it all the way back to Machiavelli, but Rousseau was another big one on this. But the 1700 Enlightenment got in kind of a love affair with Islam, mainly because they wanted to reject Christianity. They had been rejecting Christianity since the early 1500s, so they saw Christianity as the worst enemy, and that meant that any other religion had to be better. And they liked Islam, I think, in part because, you know, it got rid of Trinitarianism, which they thought was irrational, but also it took Christianity as the enemy. And finally, I think they like the sexual mores of Islam in the sense of, it in some senses, very much looser than Christianity and allowing for polygamy. So you have a lot of weird things coming together, and also sexual slavery. So, you know, you have a weird sort of love affair of the left with Islam, which refuses to see for what it is. So they're looking at Christians in Europe now still as folks are the cause of all our problems. You're so intolerant. And they're ushering in Muslims who are bent on destroying both Christians and the secularized society, and they're utterly blinded to that obvious fact.
Yeah, you know, to be fair, though, I mean, if you go back, and I think you've written about this, if you go back to the Reformation, there were Christians at that point in time that looked at Islam as the acts of God's judgment, and therefore thought that perhaps Islam was better because anything was better than the medieval Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And so they saw Islam as maybe a good in the hands of God.
That is true, actually, and I have a chapter on this in a book that I just recently released, The Reformation 500 Years Later in Islam. And indeed, in the Reformation, it was actually Luther and Calvin who both considered Islam to be the, you know, the sword of God or the the rod of God's wrath in the same way that the ancient Assyrians or Babylonians were. So they thought that the entirely corrupt Catholic Church was the cause of the problems and the reason that Islam was about to break into Europe and destroy Christendom. And Martin Luther himself wrote a translation of the Quran was published, and he himself provided the preface, and that was his point, that Islam is the rod of God's punishment, and it's actually morally superior, not only to the Roman Catholic Church, but to, oddly enough, to all Christians anywhere, showing for Luther, hey, it didn't matter, works don't matter. A sign of this is that Islam has wonderful moral works, but they're not saved. So works don't matter. So it was a weird way of treating Islam at the time, and that helped to soften up the assessment of Islam by later secular thinkers.
Do you think that we need to have a more full-orbed understanding of the Reformation? I mean, it's sort of been idealized, and a lot of people are celebrating 500 years of Reformation theology. But on the other hand, there was a whole lot more going on if you understand the cultural circumstances of the 16th century.
Oh, absolutely. And one of those things is the place of Islam, that it was, literally about to overwhelm Europe. I mean, everyone saw it pretty much as the last century the Christians would be around, because, you know, they were just looming on the borders over in modern-day Turkey and rushing into southern and eastern Europe. So that was one aspect of it. But another aspect that confuses things is that atheism had already begun in the 1400s at a kind of modern revival by recovering the ancient pagan atheists, and was spreading rather rapidly from Italy all over Europe. And the goal of that new atheism that was spreading out was to eliminate Christianity, first by stealth and then later openly. So Marxism is the full flower of that atheism that arose in that time. And if that weren't enough to complexify things, there's the rise of nationalism, where kings, and this was in all over Europe, but particularly in England and in France and in the various German principalities, these political leaders wanted their own national churches under their own power. So even if Martin Luther had never come along, they wanted their own national church. That is, not a universal church, but a state church under their control. But that creates a kind of, you know, politicized version of Christianity that is one convenient for the rulers. So there were already forces aiming at the destruction of Christianity or the splintering of Christianity, even independently of what went on with the corruption within the Catholic Church, which was very real, and the splintering effect of Protestantism.
Apart from that, I mean, you wrote a book called, I guess you referenced it as The Reformation 500 Years Later. In that book, you list a number of things that we need to know about the Reformation. If you were to maybe cite the first or second thing that you think is critical for us to know, what would that be?
Well, one of the things is something we need to know now, and that's why the title was The Reformation 500 Years Later. What do we need to know now? What we need to know now, and this was related to what I just went over, is that the Reformation is coming to a close because good Catholics and good Protestants find themselves again and again on the same side in the cultural battles, because secular liberalism is trying to destroy all Christians. Not just Catholics, not just Protestants, but all Christians. So we're finding ourselves side by side, and there's a new kind of friendship and unity springing out of that that really could bring the Reformation to a close. Another common, another thing that has the same effect is the just mentioned attack on Islam. Islam doesn't care if you're Catholic or Protestant or what kind of Protestant you are or whether you're Orthodox. It's just trying to wipe the infidel out. And so once again, Catholics and Protestants and Greek Orthodox are finding themselves with a common enemy, and so we have a common friendship. And so one of the things that people need to know is we're faced with a new opportunity to bring about a Christian unity once again. And we can do that if we understand clearly what happened in the original Reformation, how all sides made mistakes, and how we can climb back out of the hole that we created. And those are the other 11 things that you need to know in the book.
Yeah, it's a great book. And, you know, let me say something about what you just said. I mean, you're saying that there should be some harmony between Catholics, between Orthodox and Protestant. If we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately.
Exactly.
That kind of idea. But there are people, and I was thinking about a guy that I've known for many, many years, John MacArthur, realizing my conversion to Eastern Orthodoxy and saying that this is a religion that is to be cursed, not to be joined, because this is a religion that teaches a crass system of works righteousness. So I think there's a sense in which we need some education within the Christian world so that people understand the soteriologies of other groups of Christians instead of just broad brushing them.
Yes, and think, you know, I like to use this image. Think of us all being in a castle, as in the Lord of the Rings, and the orcs are about to overtake us, and there we are standing side by side, all these Protestants, Catholics, and the Orthodox. Now, how do we want to carry on our common task? Do we want to be fighting each other over these differences, or do we want to understand these differences more deeply and, as you say, see why it is each side held this or that position and historically came to that and what they really mean, and more importantly, what they don't mean? You know, one of the things that the printing press did at the time of Luther, it began, you know, about 50 years before Luther came on the scene, but it's sort of like modern Twitter and Facebook. It made people say things too quickly and harden into positions and portray the other person in ways that weren't actually true, didn't go to the heart of it. So we need to undo that. And part of what would help, and you're pointing to this, is, well, let's understand what's really going on. You know, let's really look deeply at history. Look at the deep history of the Orthodox. Look at the deep history of the Catholic Church, of what happened with Luther and the Anabaptists and the Calvinists, and let's try to get some understanding of why certain positions may have been held and what we might do, not to just blur the edges. We don't want to do that, but to say, you know, well, maybe it's not quite what we thought it was. Maybe, for example, Greek Orthodox Church or the Roman Catholic Church really aren't engaged in works righteousness. Maybe if we read the documents, we'd find that's not what's going on. So, you know, there's a lot of misinformation and little hardening of the intellectual arteries out there. So I don't want to make it seem as if the task before us is an easy one. But, wow, you know, when you're getting attacked by Islam in Europe, it should soften up your ability to talk to your fellow Christians a bit. The same thing true with when we're fighting against gay marriage and abortion and who knows what other atrocity in regard to pornography. Wow, you know, we're trying to save marriage. I think we can come to some agreement about saving marriage, even if we can't quite come to an agreement about whether it's a sacrament or not.
You bring up abortion. I can't help but in concert with that. I mean, if you're doing a word association, when I think about abortion, I immediately think Sanger, Margaret Sanger.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think about applied science, the applied science of eugenics. She was on the forefront of the eugenics movement, and this is a movement that had enormous implications for human civilization.
Absolutely, and this is Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. And speaking of banning books, her book, The Pivot of Civilization, is one book you can't get from Planned Parenthood. They don't even want you to know it exists. If Planned Parenthood could burn one book in this world, it would be Margaret Sanger's Pivot of Civilization, because you read it, and the hair on your head will stand up straight. I treat Mein Kampf too, Hitler's Mein Kampf. And I think that Sanger's book is worse, because the way that she talks about people is, look, there's the good people, and then there's the biological waste. Now, I'm not making that term up. That's her term. There are the imbeciles and the morons, the biological waste, who should never have been born. And the best thing we can do is at least not let them breed. And that's why we want birth control. So the origin of the birth control movement for Margaret Sanger, the foundress of Planned Parenthood, was eugenic. We've got all these no good people breeding, and we need to stop it. We need to stop them. And she was part of the worldwide eugenic movement that also flowed into Nazi Germany, but was all not just in Germany, it was in England, all over America, and exists today. Planned Parenthood still does the same thing, but they do it through, you know, prenatal screening and abortion. So they're doing the same thing that the Nazis did, killing the unborn for any of a number of reasons. Oh, you know, it's a boy and I wanted a girl. It might have Down syndrome. Oh, it might have this disease or that disease, or I just don't want it now. It's just as ruthless as the Nazis, and it's going on all around the country. And that's Margaret Sanger's Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, and it's this is one person I think people ought to be more familiar with.
Yeah.
And also familiar with the fact that if you think about eugenics, a lot of people will think about that applied science within Nazi Germany, but you think about who was funding this. You have philanthropies like the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations. Yeah. You have research at Stanford and Harvard and Yale and Princeton. You have legislation which is passed in states ranging from North Carolina to New York to California. And it's even backed as a science by the National Academy of Sciences and the American Medical Association. And back then, those who would resist the idea were considered backward and ignorant. And it was the German scientists for a while before this eventually reached its nadir. It was the German scientists who were thought of as being progressive and forward-thinking.
Absolutely, yeah, and we don't want to, again, just blame the Germans. This was, this was the so-called progressive dicta. You know, this is what we should be doing. We need to take evolution into our own hands. And this was understood to be the most scientific, leading edge thinking. So it wasn't backward folk who thought this, who were the real racists and the real eugenicists. It was the leading scientists in all the universities in Europe and America, and hence also a lot of research and funding came from those sources that you mentioned. Wherever there's something bad happening, the Rockefeller Foundation is usually behind it, or the Ford Foundation, so you find their bad money thrown around in there. But the reason this was understood to be the latest scientific way to go, the whole eugenics movement, is because it has its roots in Charles Darwin. And this is one other book that, please don't burn it, may everyone read it cover to cover. It's Charles Darwin's Descent of Man, the book Charles Darwin wrote after The Origin of Species to make clear what the evolutionary implications were for human nature. And one of those implications that he spelled out very clearly is, look, we've got to stop standing in the way of natural selection. Natural selection eliminates the weak. When you stand in the way of natural selection and you have this perverse notion of charity, such as one would get from Christianity, then you keep saving the weak, and that dilutes our evolutionary climb up the slopes and drags us back down. So Charles Darwin was the scientist, the leading scientist, and a lot of other scientists came from him, defining the eugenics movement, because it's really just taking evolution into your own hands. And eugenics is artificial selection for the sake of breeding better and better human beings and eliminating as Margaret Sanger would say, the dead weight of human waste. So this awful idea really did come from Darwin, but it spread all over Europe. And Adolf Hitler is one one way that it manifested itself, but not the only way. Margaret Sanger found us at Planned Parenthood another way, but it pervaded everywhere. And so, as you're saying, you know, you were considered backward if you questioned eugenics, and that's turning good and evil upside down.
You think about Darwin, and you've written about this, but one of the famous quotes that I recall from your book, written by The Descent of Man, where you're commenting on Darwin's incredible applications to human beings in terms of this applied science. He says, there is reason to believe that vaccination has preserved thousands who from a weak constitution would formerly have succumbed to smallpox. Thus, the weak members of a civilized society propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. It is surprising how soon a want of care, or care wrongly directed, leads to the degeneration of a domestic race. But excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed. I mean, I don't know how it gets clearer than that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, how this is not difficult to discern, the evil inherent in this, and we nobody wants to say Charles Darwin would ever say something like that, and you'll find scientists trying to distance Darwin from the eugenics movement and say, well, that's not Darwin. He was just about biology. Well, that's just not true. Now, they may be ignorant scientists, which is likely, but they also may know, and they're trying to cover it up. And my suspicion is they just don't know, and that's why I think that Darwin's Descent of Man should be required reading in every high school, along with Margaret Sanger's The Pivot of Civilization, because they go hand in hand.
Here's a book that was required reading back in the early 20th century, a high school biology text that talked about the improvement of man and says that if the stock of domesticated animals can be improved, it is not unfair to ask if the health and vigor of future generations of men and women on Earth might not be improved by applying to them the law of selection, and then goes on to find a remedy. The remedy is that if such people were lower animals, we would probably kill them off to prevent them from spreading. We do have the remedy of separating the sexes in asylums or other places and in various ways preventing intermarriage. And the possibilities of perpetuating such a low and degenerate race, remedies of this source have been tried successfully in Europe and are now meeting with success in this country. And there's sort of a really interesting backstory to this. We're all sort of, well, pretty much everyone is familiar with Inherit the Wind.
Yes.
And it makes, well, Christians look like bigoted ignoramuses, and it makes the people who believe in eugenics look like, well, blessed intellectuals.
Yes.
But in reality, this book played a part in that film, but not the part we hear about.
Exactly. It's sort of maddening. I want to get together a bunch of donors and make a remake of Inherit the Wind when they just stop right in the middle of it and they read from the textbook. That's George Hunter's textbook that was actually at stake in the original Scopes trial where you had Clarence Darrow, and say, okay, well, what is in that textbook? And you just read it. I ran it. This was an act of providence. I ran into that textbook at a Goodwill. And it was the first time I read it. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is amazing. And so I quoted from it in 10 Books That Screwed Up the World to show people how backwards their understanding of what really happened is. So what you actually have is not just a teaching of evolution at stake in the Scopes trial, but the fact that it was teaching positive eugenics, you know, you got to breed better. You got to take out the biological waste and only let the best breed with the best. And this is prior to the rise of the Nazis. So it is part of that American and European understanding that, hey, to be on the cutting edge of science means to be eugenic. And so here that textbook is actually one of the most abominable things that could ever been, and it should be on trial itself. And was William Jennings Bryan actually knew that, and that was one of his major objections. Well, you never see that in the movie. All they think is, oh, this is just about, irrational Bible thumpers, when this is about saving humanity from the scourge of eugenics.
You know, there is a quote that I memorized many, many years ago with respect to Darwin, but let me simply resign myself for the purposes of the communication with you to indicate the takeaway from that quote being that there's a gradation of human races. And Darwin was very specific about that. The Caucasian is at the top, and down at the bottom, dangling at the edge of humanity, you have the Negro or Australian.
Yes.
And the Negro or Australian was just an evolutionary hair's breadth away from the gorilla. You think about this kind of language, and yet you have Richard Dawkins trying to absolve his mentor, a Darwin, his idol Darwin, from outright racism.
Yeah, and that's just nonsense. That's why, again, we want to read the shocking passages from Darwin's Descent of Man, where when he's describing the ranking of the races, first of all, he's doing really, unscientific things like measuring skulls and saying, well, look how big the European skulls all look, especially how big the English skull is. And then look at all these small-skulled folks who all happen to be, as you say, Asians or Aborigines or Negroes. They all have small heads. Well, that shows you that they are less evolutionary developed. That means that we're not part of a common race, but each race is an evolutionary branch. That's what people don't realize. When Darwin talks about races, human races, he means not that we have races of human nature, but that what we call humans are divided into a variety of races, which are what we can call incipient species. That is, they're literally new species coming into being and will soon be, not related very closely at all, maybe not even be able to interbreed. Well, what's going to happen even before that is, and he's quite clear about this, the extermination of the lesser races, the lesser human species, and the extermination of the higher apes. And we're going to have then this big gap, he says, between something maybe even higher than the European and then some really low, non-human-like ape. It'll just be part of the ongoing extinction process. And that extinction process occurs through the struggle for existence, and that includes war. So really he's giving a scientific sanction for racial extinction as simply part of what the future of evolution will be. He doesn't say, let's not do this. He says, this is what's going to happen because this is the way that evolution works. And that's just a deeply pernicious part of his theory. It's an amazing thing, but no one wants to talk about it.
And then it was the blacks.
Yeah.
But now it is the whites. I was just reading an article, Jesse Daniels. She's a college professor, her specialty at the City University of New York's Hunter's College's Internet Manifestations of Racism. So she is purported to be an expert on race, racism, and technology. Uh-huh. And she's pointing out that white people have to forgo reproduction because the white nuclear family is one of the most powerful forces supporting white supremacy. She also believes that it is racist for whites to have mixed race children, because that in some way or other is prostituting the human race. It is pretty interesting how far you can get away from truth if you don't have a North Star to guide you.
Exactly. And you're thinking, gosh, if any white person said this about any other race, they would be hided out of town. yet you can say it about the white races. And you know, what you have here is there's so much ignorance about the actual background of these ideas that you have somebody like that say something, and we have no idea why they would say it, what the implications are, where these ideas may have come from. Well, those ideas undoubtedly were put in her head by white males. That is, you know, coming from any of the number of books in 10 books that screwed up the world, you'll find out, well, this seems a lot like a transformed kind of Marxism. Okay, well, Marx was a white male atheist. So you have the racial theories. Well, you have Darwin's Descent of Man, where, you know, races are going to be sort of irredeemably stuck in their racial niche, and there's not much you can do but stop them from breeding. Okay, well, you know, if you're using bad ideas from white males, does that make it any better if you're trying to use it against white people?
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about Nietzsche. You wrote about Nietzsche. You know, Darwin, we were talking about, his emphasis was on the survival of the fittest and the struggle for existence. But Nietzsche went beyond survival to this concept of the will to power of the fittest. Talk about that little bit of a ironic twist.
Yeah, he is. He's actually going back all the way to Thomas Hobbes, who argued that there is actually no rationality. It's our will that drives our reason. And so he didn't put it in terms of will to power, but for Thomas Hobbes, and this is writing in the middle of the 1600s, there is no, you know, rationality is a servant to the passions, a servant to the will. Well, Nietzsche, four centuries later, takes that up, but he's got Darwin to help him along. And so he takes Darwin's idea for the struggle for existence and argues that there is no rationality in regard to the human struggles. What you have are strong wills and weak wills, and the strong wills survive, and they use the weak-willed and weak members of the society to advance their own will. So for Nietzsche, the best example is somebody like the Pharaoh of Egypt, who simply uses people to create his own godlike empire, with him at the top of the pyramid, quite literally, and using everyone else as a slave, because, look, it creates this wonderful monument and this great person. So Nietzsche argues that the will to power is the primary driving force in human history, but that is it's actually kind of a subset of what he calls the will to live, that you find in the plant and animal kingdom, where one thing exterminates another and consumes it and increases its own strength.
You mentioned Thomas Hobbes. You just alluded to him. And I think we ought to go back to thinking about what he had to say and its impact on society today, because a lot of us don't realize that the great Hobbesian protest in our day is, no one has the right to tell me what to do. In other words, they hear that moniker, but they don't understand that is tied inextricably to the teachings of Thomas Hobbes.
Exactly. And Hobbes, again, was an atheist materialist. And so what his argument is, look, at bottom there's just matter frantically bouncing around. And human beings are made of matter, and they frantically bounce around. They don't really have any aim, but they just want to pursue what gives them pleasure and avoid whatever gives them pain. And this occurs in a moral void. There's no God. There's just matter. And so he argues that in this state of nature, as we call it, where human beings are just bouncing off each other, doing anything they want, there's no good and evil. There's just whatever you can get, that we each have the right to self-preservation by any means possible. And it's that affirmation, or literally the invention of the notion of modern rights, that brings about our idea today that you have a right to do whatever you want. and there's no moral framework that those rights exist in, all you need to do is claim that you have the right, and you have the right, because it's, as Hobbes argued, a right is a fancy name you give for the thing you want a lot. And there isn't any more depth to it than that. So what we find ourselves in is a kind of a Hobbesian predicament today where everyone's claiming to have a right to whatever they happen to desire, and as Hobbes predicted even then, it causes complete societal chaos, which is what we're experiencing, the battling of groundless right claims.
Yeah, interesting. If you go back to Descartes, there's a famous dictum, I think, therefore I am, but you've pointed out in your books that that inevitably leads to a corollary error, and that is, since God is caused by our thinking him, he is merely a subjective projection of our own egos.
Yes, and so what we have in Descartes, he actually is in the same league as Hobbes. He's really a materialist. And for him, we're the ones that are the cause of ideas in the universe. That is, we're the cause of the ideas that we call truth. And so we're makers of ideas. The universe itself is a kind of a randomly contrived material mess, but we impose ideas on things. And that means that human beings are the only source of truth in the universe. That's the reason why he says, I think, therefore I am, because human beings are now the source of all intellectual order. There is no God. Now, Descartes, he actually pretends there's a God, but there's not. He was actually an atheist. So what you have in Descartes is the origin of the notion that there's no truth out there, that we each individually impose our own truth on things. And so he's really the modern inventor of what we've now called subjectivity. That is, there isn't really any rational way for us to get into a discussion about what's out there. We each want to impose a kind of order on things as if we were God. And the reason we can do that is because no God exists.
Let's apply this, all of what we've talked about, to parenting. I mean, you've got a lot of kids, not as many as I do. I have 12, so I've got you dwarfed by comparison. But anyway, the whole idea of raising kids today, in an age in which we have smartphones and video games and a abundance of historical ignorance, which would seem to me is the prescription for simply allowing history to repeat itself.
Yes. And what happens is that people who are plugged into smartphones, as we all are, unfortunately, and into the internet through computers, are simply immersed in the present day. They have no context that would allow them, deep historical context, that would allow them to judge the images that are flitting in front of them. So you can tell people anything who don't know the past. I mean, in other words, you can tell them anything about Europe because they don't know anything about Europe. You can tell them anything about Islam because they don't know anything about Islam. You can tell them anything about anything because they have no background, which would allow them to judge. And so one of the things that I hope to do in this 10 Books of Screwed Up the World is say, if you don't understand where these ideas came from in the past and the history of how they unfolded, you aren't thinking original thoughts. You are using borrowed thoughts, thoughts that you yourself don't understand, yet you think are original, and that makes you easy, very easy, to manipulate by others through the internet and through the other media, because you don't know enough to understand the deep analysis of anything that's put before you. You simply accept it as it is, and then conjure up whatever judgment you happen to have about it, which can't be very deep.
How does it apply from your perspective to Christian education?
Well, the focus, unfortunately, on Christian education is not deeply historical. And I don't mean just the history of Christianity. We Christians should know about the history of the world because Christianity is evangelizing the world, it's been in the world, and so you really need to understand not only the history of the Christianity, but also the history of all of the various areas that are coming into our focus now. And that would include, whatever is a hot spot, like over in Syria, but also, you know, the American history and European history. So without our understanding these things, again, we're subject to all kinds of manipulation, and that makes us not only bad citizens, but bad Christians. We don't know we don't know what's going on in regard to Christianity, and Christianity is evangelizing the world, and we're lost there too.
Yeah, and you think about where we are in human history today. I just wrote a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. It was released October this year. And you look at Islam being the fastest growing religion in the world today, and in the near future, if things don't change, it also will become the largest religion in the world, overtaking Christianity. And you have to lay the blame at the doorstep of Christians, because if pagans or Muslims are willing to do for a lie what Christians are not willing to do for the truth, we're going to lose in the battle of ideas.
Yeah, exactly. And the most egregious example of the problem is Europe, because Europe has, it's secularized itself. It's actively eliminated Christianity with almost the same fervor that Muslims want to eliminate Christianity. And what that's left them with is a complete moral and political vacuum. And into that vacuum is rushing.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And countries that become Islamic demographically are inevitably going to become Islamic politically as well.
And culturally. I mean, you know, it's not only that Christianity will be outlawed, and if there are churches that stand, you won't be able to come outside them, and they'll be closing them down, but all the secular institutions will be eliminated as well. I mean, it's not, you know, I think that Europeans think that it'll be a secular state and Muslims will be milling about, but it becomes an Islamic state, and that's the end of secularism.
But so many people have drank the Kool-Aid thinking that Islam is a religion of peace and tolerance. I mean, that mantra has been bandied about in so many different circumstances, so many different cultures. The cultural elite have this engraved upon the tablet of their consciousness, and this is now being passed down to kids. And if you so much as suggest that Islam is not a religion of peace and tolerance, it's tantamount to being bigoted.
Yeah, and again, that's a reflex of these sort of the 1700s love affair with Islam of the secular left that's come down to us today. The reason, again, the secular left is in a way so hostile to that news that Islam might not be the religion of peace is that if it's actually true that Islam is doing what it's doing because of Islam, and that's not good. In fact, it's worse than Christianity. That makes their whole centuries-long project turn out wrong. They're just wrong about religion. They're wrong about Christianity. They're wrong about Islam. And since they themselves are unable to function in a world which Islam threatens, they're wrong that their own worldview will be able to sustain itself and lead to some kind of rosy future. So in a lot of ways, they're passionate, you know, protesting against telling what Islam is really like is a way for them to protect their own view of the world.
Oh, wow. Talking about all of this can make you very, very depressed.
Don't get depressed.
What is the silver lining here? I mean, do you think that there's a possibility? When you think about reformations, when you think about the power of one, you think there is a possibility that we can as yet turn this situation around?
Well, I read somewhere, I don't remember quite where it was, but something to the effect that with God, all things are possible. And if you, I'll have to check that quote. And if you look back over the history of Christianity, there have been some really awful times. And that isn't to make light of the situation we're in, but it is to allow us to know that, you know, that, that God's grace and human effort, if, you know, we will answer the call that God gives us, we can have a great effect. I mean, remember the first Christians were born in the Roman Empire. As I recall, the Romans weren't too excited about that. They tried to exterminate them. And so we, you know, that the first Christians are the ones that evangelized, began the evangelization of Europe under the absolute worst conditions, and that evangelization just needs to happen again. And I do think the world is hungry for it. You know, the secularism is ending up being an empty dish. And I think the effect of pornography, the destruction of the family, the foolishness of what's going on in Europe and now the American trying to judge Islam is waking enough people up, but they need to be evangelized and to have the erroneous views removed and the correct understanding put in its place.
You know, so much of Christianity today, though, is transactional. You know, so people become baptized secular humanists and really don't make an impact on the culture. They're conformed by the culture in place of transforming the culture. And the moment you say that Christianity is more than transactional, it's more than pray this prayer and now you've got the get out of jail card free, the moment you say that, then a lot of people are saying, well, you're trying to add works to your Christianity, and yet works are inextricably woven into our faith. I mean, James says, you show me your faith, I'll show you my faith by what I do.
Yeah.
A man is justified not by faith alone, but by works as well. In fact, the only place we find the moniker in this relationship is with respect to works.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that given the kind of attack that the secular left has had against all Christians in the culture wars, that many Protestants are saying, we got to do something. God is calling us to fight against abortion. God is calling us to fight against gay marriage. God is calling us to fight against pornography. And we're going to be judged by whether we answer that call or not. Now, that's an admission that we have to do something. You know, and it's Protestant as well as Catholic and Greek Orthodox. So there are some people who are, you know, sort of bent on reciting the mantra, you save by faith alone. But there's so many good evangelicals who are out there in the front lines in the culture wars, and they're not pretending that they're saving their souls, but they realize there's a connection between where you are in the cultural war and what you do and the future of Christianity and the future of their own soul, really.
You think about the plight of the poor and the downtrodden, and that most of the world is living on a couple of dollars a week, or sometimes only a couple of dollars even a month. The incredible poverty that we have in the world, if we don't as Christians meet the needs of others, how can we truly say we're followers of the one who taught us to give the piece of bread, the cup of water in his name?
Yeah, and there's obvious places in the Gospels, you know, especially Mark and Luke and Matthew, where we are called to do certain things. And, you know, one of them, loud and clear, is you need to care for the poor, you need to care for widows and orphans, you need to love your enemies, all the things that we don't want to hear, and there are no loopholes around, and they are all contingent, our salvation seems to be contingent on them. And as Jesus has these, you know, horrible, frightening things, he said, you know, if you can be with the sheep or the goats, and the difference is, you either follow me or you didn't. You did these things to others, you did them to me. And if you didn't do them, then you didn't do them to me. So it really does matter what we do. And I, again, because of the culture wars, I think there's a great realization of that. And also among many wonderful evangelical Protestants who are doing work with the poor all around the world. So that action itself maybe speaks louder than the doctrines, if I can say that.
Yeah, and you look at James, he says, you see, that faith and actions are working together.
Yep.
That a person is justified by what he does and not by faith alone. Those words so strong that Luther actually thought that this book, the book of James, written by our Lord's brother, has to be an epistle of straw.
Yeah, and that was unfortunate of him. And in his preface to his translation of the New Testament, he made the unfortunate move of saying, you know, really, actually, Matthew, Mark, and Luke aren't really that important. You could let them out. And the reason that he downplayed those three Gospels is there's an obvious affirmation of you've got to be holy if you want salvation. You've got to contribute your part. God's grace is what allows us to do it, but you have to respond. And so he downplayed those three Gospels and said, really, the key message is in St. Paul's letter to the Romans. That's how you interpret the entire gospel. And then he was faced with the obvious difficulties. Why did Jesus say we had to do these things to get into heaven? And his answer was to show you that you couldn't do them. He wasn't actually telling you to do them. He was trying to show you that you couldn't do them, so you would accept justification by faith alone. That's just not adequate. That's twisting the real meaning of the gospels. And Luther is not to be cherished for that particular move.
You know, the common sense example that James gives, something to the effect that Rahab the prostitute considered righteous in her life for what she did, says James, because she gave lodging to spies. She sent them off in a different direction. And so the conclusion for James is the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. But the moment you say that, or even quote James saying that, people immediately have this idea that you're teaching some kind of a crass system of works righteousness, which is really not the point he's making when you consider the totality of what he's writing about.
True, and another important aspect of James' argument is he talks about Abraham doing what God asked, even though it looked from a human perspective foolish. You know, what do you mean get up from the land in which I was born and go off somewhere else because of this promise? Well, what James is trying to show us is if you believe this, then you will do this because that shows that you believe it. And so if you believe Christ died for everyone, you will be good to your enemies. You will endure persecution. So that it's the belief calls for a certain account of action. And if you don't follow through with that action, then you must not believe the thing that you said you believed. And so he really has a much different spin on the Abraham story than Luther tried to put on it.
To make sure I absolve you from all heresy, let me just ask you straight out.
A big task on your part.
Yeah, I mean, it's the problem is people listening in, I mean, they have these monikers in their minds, and if you don't simply agree to the moniker, whether it's one, two, three, or four words, then you're outside the camp. But you would give assent to what Paul said when he said in Ephesians, it is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. And then he goes on to say, for we are God's workmanship created in Christ Jesus to do good works.
Yeah. And Paul is Saint Paul, and he's right. And he also says other things too. You know, we don't want to just take certain passages out, but clearly, in order to act in accordance with the revealed truth that Christ gave us, we have to be given the faith. We can't even believe it without his help, because it's greater than our mind can grasp, let alone can we do anything without his help. So grace is always the beginning point. In fact, it's a grace that human beings were created to begin with, that I can scratch my head and blink my eyes. Those are all gifts. But you need the supernatural gifts in order to follow the kinds of commands that Christ is giving us. He's not just giving us merely mortal commands. These are commands that only make sense if you believe the truth that Jesus Christ died for our sins, that he was truly God incarnate, and that even if we die in martyrdom or die spending our life serving the poor or whatever we're doing, then we will receive eternal life. So a Christian's life makes sense in terms of the next life, and to be able to act for that is of necessity the result of grace. So it's all grace, but God creates us also to have to respond to grace. We're given two good eyes, how do we use them? We're given two good hands, how do we use them? We're given the faith, do we act accordingly?
I could talk to you forever, but at some point we have to bring this podcast to a close.
That would be a long time.
Yeah. You received your PhD again from Vanderbilt. You are a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute. Just a quick comment on some of my favorite books we've talked about many times on the broadcast. We've also talked about in a recent podcast, A Meaningful World, How the Arts and Sciences Reveal the Genius of Nature, that book co-authored with Jonathan Witt. What are you trying to get across?
Well, I'll put it in its grandest terms. We're literally trying to undo 500 years of reductionist physics, meaning by that, you know, the whole materialist view of nature is at the root of our self-destruction. If we don't think we have a soul and could be reduced to mere atoms that were randomly contrived, we can't ever live a good and meaningful life. And so what Meaningful World tries to do is to build up an understanding of nature, an understanding of science, which is anti-reductionist, which actually affirms our ability to choose things, to think things, and to act freely. And it's not based on mere wishful thinking. It's based on the latest science. I follow up on that, by the way, in a newer book, In Defense of Nature, as well.
Yeah. Another book that I wanted to mention briefly, I don't think we've ever discussed this, but it's a book you co-authored with Scott Hahn, best known in my world in terms of his association with Catholic Answers. I just did an interview with them recently. But that's the book Answering the New Atheism, Dismantling Richard Dawkins' Case Against God. That's a very necessary piece of work.
Yeah, unfortunately, Dawkins' book, I mean, how long ago was that published? My word. But it's still, you know, you look at Amazon, it's still one of the top-selling atheists screeds out there, and it's really an awful book. Even some of the atheists thought this is just absolutely horrific reasoning. So what we did in the book is take his arguments piece by piece, because he's by far the most influential atheist, and show, well, this is, you know, here's the fault of this, here's the defect here, here is the counter argument. So what we try to provide in Answering the New Atheism is, here is what you need to know about why Dawkins is wrong and what the right arguments are.
Yeah, maybe we should elaborate on that real quickly. I mean, you think about some of these great, great books, or books that are, well, purportedly great, and you actually read them? It's sort of like the Quran, the Noble Quran. It's supposed to be the most unbelievable linguistic tapestry in the history of the human race. But when you actually read it, it's a discombobulated progression of words. And that can be said by so many of these books that are touted. I was thinking about the Gospel of Judas. You know, this is a book that is supposedly far more erudite than the Gospel of John, far more linguistically sophisticated. You read it and you end up belly laughing.
Well, that's true, and that attempt to bring up these new gospels that had been rejected but really contained the truth, that is an old trick. It was actually an Enlightenment trick. Scott Hahn and I deal with that in a very thick, more academic book called Politicizing the Bible. But that's a way to try to undermine the Christian scriptures by saying, oh, well, they didn't put this in, this in, this in, and this is really what Jesus did. And usually it's a very watered-down account of Jesus that makes him some kind of a moral teacher or New Age mystic.
Another book, maybe quickly, In Defense of Nature. This has to do with the unity of environmental, economic, and moral ecology.
Yes, and simply put, what I'm trying to do is get the left and the right together and say, look, folks, let's defend all of nature. Let's defend the environment, and let's defend human nature. Because there's such a thing as industrial pollution in the water, but there's also such a thing as moral pollution in human culture, such as pornography. So what we need is a comprehensive view, that is a view that understands both nature and human nature as part of our an ecology, so that we can talk about a moral ecology, and we can talk about violations of human nature as a kind of pollution that we must act against.
I have a copy of your book in front of me. It's all marked up, and I was just furiously, as you were talking, flipping through it. But there's this quote in the book that bears some elaboration. It's just fantastic. We need to see, you said, far more deeply how interconnected true ecology really is, how the natural order, especially as it includes us human beings, necessarily has essentially theological, social, economic, and moral dimensions that will surprise and enlighten both the left and right and reveal a truly Catholic ecology.
Yes. And so I interweave all that. And again, I'm trying to surprise people and get people on the left to understand, hey, human beings are the only moral creature. They're the only ones that pollute things. That means they're the only ones that can choose to do that or choose not to do it. Well, if we discover we're moral creatures, then maybe the universe isn't randomly contrived by amoral or non-moral chance. Maybe there's an intelligent moral being behind it, and human beings are made in his image. Maybe we can understand more about the ecology as a relationship to economics. And we can understand, hey, you know, it's not all about profit. It's about what effect we have on human beings and on nature. Both have had to be taken into account. So the what I'm trying to shoot for in defense of nature is bringing the whole debate about morality and ecology into a much wider and deeper context that, you know, turns out actually is very Christian. But in this sense, we can do it in a way that allows everyone in the public debate on the natural grounds to understand it.
I love your bio. You live in rural Ohio with your beloved wife, with seven children, with sundry goats, chickens, rabbits, dogs, cats, and whatever else happens to wander along.
Those were some time back. We've gotten rid of the goats and the chickens. As much as I miss the chickens, I don't miss the goats, and now I know why they have the position they do in the gospel. So I recommend against getting them.
I have some family members that have raised chickens, and that's a whole other story. I mean, there's an ecology in the hen house that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is, and I use that for my students to get them to understand why it is you can't erase gender in nature by, you know, we don't have enough contact with nature, and that's why we in the West think you can fiddle around with gender, but all you need to do is be with animals enough, and you realize, you know, males and females are really different.
Benjamin, you are amazing. I love my discussions with you. I love reading your books. You're making an impact for time and for eternity.
I hope so. I hope so. Sometimes one just sits and writes the books and you think, what am I doing? Is anyone reading them? So it is always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, and do remember the Hank Unplugged podcast is available wherever podcasts are consumed. Some housekeeping details. Well, maybe the housekeeping detail. Go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. That's an action point that'll make a difference for this podcast as we're seeking to become number one. I mean, we reached number 6 with our very first podcast, but, you know, things can atrophy if you're not careful. So we want to get you involved. Again, go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. Of course, if you believe it's worth a 5-star rating, you can always share the podcast with others, rate, review, and let people know that we are absolutely determined to bring the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet right to you. You can listen in to conversations that'll make a difference, not only for time, but also for eternity. We're out of time for this particular podcast, but remember the Hank Unplugged podcast, also the Bible Answer Man broadcast, the books that I've mentioned on the broadcast today, available at equip.org, or when you write me a post office box, 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Thanks for tuning in. See you next time with more of Hank Unplugged.